My people once lived in caves, and we then learned to build huts, and in time to build ships like this one.
Perhaps one day my people will travel above the skies.
Of that I have absolutely no doubt.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton. I'm the guy sitting in that trial for humanity. I'm one of the jurors, Cam.
And the judge.
And the judge. I've got an awesome robe to wear. Yeah. Cam, what is our conundrum this week?
Well, it's a very, very special event. We are going to talk about TNG at 30 and ask... Is it the greatest Trek?
Okay, well, we'll save the answer to the very end because I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But Cam, we're going to cover a whole bunch of different topics, but I think what we want to do is sprinkle throughout this episode maybe five episodes each that we think really exemplify what Star Trek is. Maybe not every single one of the top 10 best episodes that typically appear on everyone's lists.
Yeah, I definitely didn't pick like some of my favorites. I want to talk about the ones that really... no other series could have done, and that exemplify why TNG is TNG.
Okay. Why don't we start with our first couple picks? You do one, I do one, and then throughout this episode, we'll do our so on and so forth, more episodes from there.
Okay, well, I'll start. Yeah, I wanted to include The Measure of a Man, because, you know, season two was so great for TNG. It was a little rocky, but this episode, yes. I think, is so important because it really nails down the social conscience of TNG. There's other episodes that touch on this theme I considered, like iBorg, you know, the idea of defending a human being or a character as being an individual and why that's important. You know, you never really saw that on the original series, and not with the seriousness that TNG tackles it and the sensitivity. And I thought Measure of a Man is the one that I think does it the best.
Do you think this is where... people start to consider Data, you know, one of the fan favorites at this point, or do you think he was a fan favorite prior to this? Do you think this is where he had really earned it?
I think this, I mean, I would suspect this episode was a response. I think they knew fairly early on Data was a fan favorite.
Yeah.
And may have suspected, you know, when they're having him play, you know, Sherlock Holmes, they must suspect that maybe he's going to follow the line like Spock and also be a fan favorite. But I think this episode happens because they know for a fact this is their big heavy hitter.
Yeah, I great episode, Cam. My pick going forward here, this is one, again, I don't think any other series could have tackled it in the way that they did. And this is not going to land on a whole bunch of top 10 lists, but I went with The Perfect Mate.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, of course, that's where we have Famke Janssen. She's playing this alien species that's essentially they're made to be the perfect mate for, you know, some ambassador, what have you. And, she falls for Picard, and he falls for her.
Well, how could she not?
Well, I know, but it's such an exquisite episode where I remember watching it as a young person for the first time, and I was kind of bored, actually. It's like a nine-year-old Tyler. I was just like, it wasn't for me. I watched it again as an adult, and it seemed like such an adult version of Star Trek.
Right.
It's so many themes, and I just love Patrick Stewart's performance, especially at the very end of this episode. I've brought it up before, but we have an ambassador, or no, it was essentially Famke Janssen's minder, who's like, hey, I can't believe you were able to resist her. Good on you, Jean-Luc. And he just has this look in his face, and he just like walks out of the corridor. So it's left up to the interpretation of the viewer. But if you look at Patrick Stewart, he is playing it as if like, no, I failed it. I wasn't perfect. I had relations with this woman. I couldn't help myself.
That's an interesting pick because, you know, I could see that story being in the original series. But I think what separates TNG from the original series is how they tackle that sort of material. Like TNG, there's a seriousness. There's a very adult, you know, sort of oriented approach to these sorts of stories. TNG, you know, it's kind of more the swashbuckling adventure, and you know that they would be kind of playing up the sexiness factor.
TOS.
Yeah, would be playing up more the sexiness factor of the whole thing and make it maybe a little goofy.
Like, I could imagine Kirk taking that dilemma very seriously.
Yes.
But even if it's obvious by the end that he, you know, did not fulfill his duties there as he should have, they would have played it off like, oh, Kirk, you little scoundrel, you.
Right.
Whereas with Picard, you're like, wow, this guy really failed.
Yeah.
And that's what I like is when the characters on Next Gen get their hands a little dirty where they're a little imperfect. So.
Yes, very much so.
So maybe that's a perfect way to segue into our first topic here. Or why don't we call them quadrants, Cam? Why not?
I like that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the characters and what they mean to us. This is going to be such a fun question because I'm putting you on the spot, Cam. I want an answer within 1 second. Favorite character from Star Trek The Next Generation?
Picard.
Okay. Yeah, I'm there with you as well.
Yeah.
What is it about Jean-Luc Picard that makes him such a compelling A character and compelling captain?
I think the reason Picard works so well is because of the fact he's so the anti-Kirk. You know, going in, they were like, how do we compete with Captain Kirk? He's such an icon. William Shatner is so astonishing in that role. Let's go the opposite direction. And in a lot of times, that would have failed. It would have felt awkward or weird. You know, you can imagine, say, with a slight miscasting or something, Picard could have wound up like, say, a Jellico, where you're like...
Ronnie Cox?
Yeah, Ronnie Cox from Chain of Command, where you know, you're like, this guy's just kind of a bore, and he's just kind of stilted. But, you know, Patrick Stewart is so dynamic, and I think it's the character of Picard that I think emphasizes why TNG stands apart from the other Trek series. There is a maturity and just a level of intimacy to TNG that I don't think any other series have, and it's because of the sensitivity of, I think, Patrick Stewart's performance.
When you say intimacy, are you talking about kind of the relationships between the characters or just the sorts of stories that they tackle?
I feel like the stories they tell on TNG bring you into a level of intimacy with the characters that the others don't.
Yeah.
Now, look,
I mean, you think like The Perfect Mate would be a good example of that?
I think that's a great example. Yeah, yeah, I think... You know, you can go down, you know, so many of the great hits of TNG. You know, I love DS9. I really, really love that show. But I feel like those characters' arcs are tied more to an overall story, you know, the Dominion War stuff. TNG, a lot of the episodes, you know, the characters are often very perfect on TNG, but you'll get episodes that just delve very deeply into how that character feels. Like, I think of, like, an episode like Attached, you know, with Picard and Crusher. It has a sci-fi premise, you know, they're tied together by this... technology that, you know, forces them to be stuck together and share a telepathic link. But that episode is about two adults and their feelings. And I don't know that you would ever get that really in another series with the maturity. And I mean, like this show, what I love about TNG is it was not scared to be uncool.
I know.
But it's so uncool that it becomes cool.
Like, how does it work? Like, do you think it's just kind of catching lightning in a bottle to a certain degree? Or do we have to give a lot of credit to this cast, which I think deserves a bit of a tip of the hat to?
Yeah, I think you definitely do. And this is a cast that is very unlikely to maybe happen in a show nowadays.
Yeah.
They look, a lot of them, you know, older. Even though, you know, I feel like I'm now older than several of them.
I think you are.
Even though I looked at them as like, you know, they're old adults.
They're like my parents' age.
Yeah, yeah. But it just feels like it's the grown-up Trek of the group.
Yeah. I dig it. It's something about it that wasn't quite obvious in the first few seasons, though. Do you think, you know, it took a while to find its legs, though? I don't think TNG necessarily came out of the gates with their grasp of the characters fully conceived at that point, though.
I think the problem was, you know, Gene Roddenberry was hanging on to the first two seasons, really overseeing them. And I think what happened was he was making the show guide the characters, not having the characters guide the show.
I agree.
And I think that's a huge problem because when you have a captain like Picard and, you know, mature characters like, you know, Riker, I mean, well, Riker's a little goofy in the first couple seasons, but he's still more...
But he's almost like a kind of a Kirk surrogate.
He is, but has sort of a more mature-ish look than Kirk almost. Kirk gets very emotionally swept up in things, whereas Riker never really does. And then, you know, you have Troy, who's a very, like, serious, solemn character a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so he's taking these characters who feel much more adult than a lot of TOS characters who, once an adventure started, you know, they're like goofing around and kind of joking about it. And they're putting them in stories like, you know, the Dauphin or, you know, Code of Honor or, you know, Justice, episodes that are really kind of goofy or just a little campy or silly, and these characters don't support those types of stories.
Do you think the problem was that they were taking sensibilities from the 1960s sort of era of television and trying to transplant that into 1980s, and where maybe it could have worked with the TOS crew?
Yeah.
I don't think it really translated well to the cast of actors that we have here.
People are nostalgic about the 60s for a reason. It's because it was the 60s.
Yeah.
It was an era unto itself.
They had far better fashion sensibilities in the 1960s than they did in the 1980s, that's for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But when you transplant the sensibilities of the 60s into a 1980s TV show, and it's weird because right out the gate, it's like they knew that TNG was different, but they didn't really know why, because it has a more serious kind of more aloof vibe than the original series.
I'll say part of that, though, is Gene Roddenberry sitting around for 10, 15, almost 20 years being told how you're the creator of this utopia, what a visionary you are. And I think he wanted to live up to that reputation that he had cultivated over those intervening decades between TOS and Next Gen.
No, I agree, yeah.
Yeah. So, Kim, you articulated very well why, you know, Picard is my favorite character on Next Generation, but I think a close second up has got to be one Data.
Right.
Brent Spiner, if you look at that guy's performance and how he's able to imbue emotion into this character that's not supposed to have emotions. And it's fascinating that this is a legit character arc that we see throughout Next Generation. We didn't see huge character arcs like we saw with, say, Bashir or Sisko on Deep Space Nine, but we did see a lot of development in more subtle ways for a character like Data. I think maybe the turning point for me is that's very important is an episode like Data Lore, where we can kind of see the dichotomy between Brent Spiner's performances as well as what the character could have been going down a different path and the way that they want to approach the android character. What do you think, though, about the central conflict where this is Pinocchio? This is a puppet that essentially wants to be a real boy.
I think it's a masterstroke, and it's because, you know, Data is the Spock character, but Spock on the original series never had something he was trying to strive towards.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great, fantastic character on that show, and he's so much fun to watch. But, you know, when we start the series, you know, at the Man Trap and wrap up at Turnabout Intruder, we don't feel like Spock has necessarily learned a lot over those 3 years or strove towards much.
Although he has a lot of conflict throughout that period.
Definitely.
Though. Like, he's not perfect.
Not perfect. Yeah. And he has, yeah, of course, episodes where he struggles. But the brilliance of Data is that right from the get-go, they set up what this character's journey was going to be, and they followed it for that 7 years.
Would you call him a tragic character to a certain degree in that everybody's...
because he jumps to his death and no one cares?
Yeah. But I mean, if you look at those 7 years of Next Gen, and maybe we can tackle the movies a little bit later on. If you look at those 7 years of Next Generation, this is a guy that we kind of know he's never going to achieve what he sets out to do. Even when that emotion chip is introduced, it's not necessarily... Well, it's not ever put to use on the run of the series as well. We kind of know that this is a guy who, barring some sort of cybernetic miracle, he's not going to achieve that particular goal. So I think that makes him tragic to a certain degree. It doesn't help that I think a lot of the times he was kind of the butt of the joke amongst both the crew as well as like the viewers at home.
He's good-natured, though.
I dig it, though. One other character that I want to highlight who I just... It surprises me that maybe Commander Riker does not get enough credit in hindsight over the 30-year legacy.
Why do you think that is?
I wonder if Patrick Stewart, A, is just such an exquisite actor and so distinct looking. I think Brent Spiner has that distinct kind of pop culture penetration.
Yeah.
Whereas Riker, if you talk to fans, he's a favorite up there. But I don't know if he has that pop culture penetration the way that maybe a Picard or a Data does. But I think he's such a fantastic, well-developed character. He might be just the most human aboard everybody on this particular cast. What would you say?
I agree with that. He has.
Is he the most relatable, you think?
Well, I'm definitely a Riker.
Okay,
so,
I get it.
For me, come on. I would say I agree with that. He's the only character who seems to realize how cool his job is.
Sure.
he's really getting off on this job. And what I like about Riker is that he's not flashy like Picard or Data, and maybe that's why he doesn't go as recognized.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows the big iconic Picard moments, you know, or the big Data moments, whereas like Riker, you know, people enjoy laughing about the way he sits down in a chair or his kind of like cheesy smile. And, you know, even in one of his best episodes, the first part of Best of Both Worlds, I don't think anyone thinks of that as a Riker story. They think of Picard as Locutus at the end.
I know.
And so, you know, he's always kind of upstaged by these larger personalities. But I just think Jonathan Frakes is so much fun on the show. And a lot of the reason that I really enjoy rewatching a lot of episodes is just to kind of see what Riker is going to do.
And he's never kind of left on the sidelines throughout the episodes. Even if he's doing a little bit of exposition, I think he's just got kind of this presence to him that you're drawn to him naturally. But it was amazing for me. Like, I've recently been going through rewatching Next Generation. And Jonathan Frakes is like the legit number two on the bill.
Yeah.
Like it is his, it goes, you know, Stewart and then Frakes. And it's very clear with, you see the amount of screen time that Frakes gets. So maybe that didn't translate quite into the movie stardom the way that Brent Spiner got for Data in the film franchise. But it so works on the level of the show, everything that they give him. What do you think about the plan to kill off William T. Riker and replace him with Tom Riker in, was it Second Chances, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been a fun gimmick, but I don't think it was a good decision.
Yeah. It wasn't a good decision to kill off, kill off.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think that would have been a fun gimmick for them to pull. Like, guess what? Now it's Tom Riker. And I'm sure you'd get some interesting stories out of that. But I feel like for the legacy of who the Riker character is, I think we wound up with the better decision.
Okay. I'll pitch this to you as well, because this was something hotly debated between the season 3 finale and the season 4 premiere. But what if Patrick Stewart doesn't come back to the series? Do you think...
Jellicoe.
But do you think they were setting it up for like kind of a Frakes with Commander Shelby at his side as the new number one? Do you think that dynamic could have worked for the cast? With Frakes as the series lead, essentially.
I think it would work. I question if the show would lose some of its firepower, though.
Yeah.
There's something about Riker, even though I would imagine Frakes is probably a similar age as William Shatner was in the original series.
Yeah.
There's something about Riker, he still feels young to me. He feels like younger than Kirk did on the original series.
Well, like less wise to a certain degree?
Yeah, he feels more like... Like, to me, the Riker character feels like he's learning from Picard.
Okay,
like, he's learning to become a captain through this character.
But at what point do you think... I mean, there's a certain point in the series where you're like, Riker, I think you can get your own command, you know. I think...
When do you think that is, though? Because, you know, first two seasons, I don't know if we can count those, because Riker's kind of goofy a lot of the time, right? Season 3 is a really strong season. That's the season where the show finally, you know, hits its stride. Michael Piller comes aboard and a lot of the great writers... But that's only one season, really, of where we're seeing, you know, real maturity come out of Riker. I think it would have been too soon to have him be a captain at the end of season 3.
Do you think by, say, end of season 4?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah, 4, you know, like maybe like the season 5 sweeps episode or something like that.
Okay.
Do they still do sweeps? Does it matter anymore?
I think they still do sweeps. Does it matter anymore with, you know, delayed viewing?
Yeah.
It just matters less and less than it once did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, CBS All Access, I don't think they're going to care too much about sweeps when it comes to Star Trek Discovery, right?
Right.
Cam, why don't we talk about our next picks for top episodes that exemplify Star Trek The Next Generation? I'm going to go with this one. Maybe I'm cheating a little bit in that it probably turns up on a lot of top 10 lists. But I have to go with Darmok. This is one where you realize that the Federation is not the only one that has kind of sits on like a certain moral high ground, in that other species are out there looking to communicate, looking to do outreach, and they're willing to sacrifice themselves in a way. And I love the idea of communication in science fiction, and how do we come together, humanity and other species, in a way that's kind of... exemplifies humanity at its best.
This episode is a perfect encapsulation of TNG, where it's this smash up between a hard sci-fi premise driven by relatable human characters, and that they both, you know, want positive things out of this relationship. It's not like them fighting for the entire episode.
And I love how the conflict isn't about, like, you know, consoles blowing up at the end of the episode. It's about people trying to overcome their differences in order to reach a goal. In a way, it's cooperation, it's working together. And I think that's what Star Trek The Next Generation does really well.
Well, you can see how this episode, too, is kind of like TNG's arena episode.
Sure.
You know, where that one, you know, we have Kirk and the Gorn fighting for the whole episode, and ultimately Kirk realizing, you know, that he shouldn't kill the Gorn. But this is so much more of, again, an adult story. You know, it's about two characters trying to understand each other through language. It's, I mean, Kirk is a man of action. Picard is a man of, you know, philosophy and words.
Yeah, Kirk did not need to build some gunpowder cannon.
Can you imagine if Darmok had ended that way with Picard making one of those?
I can imagine, you know, Picard lighting it and getting blown away, like just his feet up in the air. You know?
Could Picard build one?
No, I think that's a Kirk thing to do. That is such a Kirk move.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think Picard was paying attention during that academy class, whereas Kirk's ears perked up. He's just like, you can build a cannon how? Oh, I'm listening, guys.
Picard never made a potato cannon when he was in Starfleet Academy.
No, he wasn't in the right fraternity. He's like, Delta Phi. Cam, what's on your list here for another episode?
So TNG did something really great, which is they would tackle these like high concept, hard sci-fi episodes and do them in a really fun way. You know, episodes like Conundrum or Cause and Effect. The episode I picked, though, was I am a huge fan of Parallels. And this falls season 7. You know, I could have picked any of those three that I've named, right? I think they're all great episodes, but Parallels to me is just the perfect combination of, again, it's a great high concept idea. We get to see hilariously awesome character stuff and, you know, like bits of canon folded into it with, like, you know, Riker in the future or alternate, you know, future Riker.
Where the Borg would have taken over the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah. And on top of that, great character comedy with Worf and Troy's relationship.
Yeah, this one, it's kind of that sliding doors sort of shtick that, honestly, every time I see it in a TV series that I adore, I'm a sucker for it. And this is no exception. I think TNG does it so well. It also shows, look, Worf, it surprised me how one-dimensional Worf often was throughout the run of Next Generation.
Definitely.
But when you give him humanity in an episode like this, and he's not being a jerk to his son, Alexander, I really think it shows...
Or having barrels fall on him.
It really shows why the character of Worf endured throughout Star Trek The Next Generation, why he was a fan favorite, why they bring him onto Deep Space Nine and give him even more depth than what he... earned on Next Generation as well.
Yeah, it's too bad TNG never kind of honed in on what made Worf as awesome as as DS9 realized he was.
Yeah, I think they kind of knew where to go to a certain degree, but they often would stumble. I would see, you know, bits and pieces of that great Worf in a poor episode, like, say, Birthright, mm-hmm. you know? But I think just knowing what made Worf, that was something they really didn't totally discover until DS9.
Do you think there was also the issue that TNG from fairly early on was very much a hierarchy? Picard at the top, and, you know, then you're going to get Data, and then, you know, you might get Riker.
Well, whereas, Will Wheaton made that very clear.
Yes,
that, you know, like he wasn't happy that it was three people getting all the stories. And
right, which was a, you know, TOS idea concept too. But I just wonder if, like, they knew, like, Worf was great. They knew fans loved him, but they never wanted to elevate him above, you know, kind of the 4 or 5 spot.
I'll say the closest that we got, though. Well, okay, we know who the top three are. Who is the number 4?
I think it's probably Worf, right?
Yeah, because look, he gets an entire season finale and premiere devoted to him.
Yeah.
After that, why don't we just do it, Cam? Let's try to figure out.
Okay.
Who, okay. We
the
know
ladder. The ladder of power.
Okay. Picard number 1.
Yes.
I make the argument that despite what happens in the movies, Riker is the number 2 of the show, not Data.
Interesting.
And this surprised me when I was doing the rewatch. I always thought of it as Data, but you go episode by episode, Riker always has more screen time. He has more things to do. There's more episodes devoted to Riker than there is Data. And that actually surprised me when I was doing this rewatch.
Yeah, I just think they, like, full, you know, so many of the big, like, TNG favorite episodes revolve around Data.
Yeah, I know.
And his journey is so important to the show.
But in the writer's room, who's on top of that ladder, though? Is it Data or is it Riker?
Oh, man, this is so tough. I feel more put on the spot for this one than so many of the other questions I've had on this podcast. My instinct says Data.
Okay, can we do rock, scissors, paper, and then we'll decide?
Okay.
1, 2, 3. Okay. I win. I got rock. Cam got scissors. So we'll go number 2 is Riker. Number 3 is Data. Number 4, Worf. We can agree on that. 5, this is where it gets a little tricky. I would make an argument for Crusher.
You think Crusher, huh?
Beverly? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would...
Or do you think Troy
I was originally thinking Troy, but okay. Then I'm thinking, you know, Crusher gets the like kind of the juicier episodes.
She does.
Yeah, like...
But then Troy, I mean... Troy is... She's sitting next to Picard giving him advice.
And she's tied into the Riker story as well.
Yeah. Maybe it is Troy.
I think Troy has more screen time.
Okay. So
plus, they, you know, we've seen famously, Troy is featured on merchandise that Crusher is cropped out of. So yeah, that would make me think that maybe Troy is the bigger character.
Well, it also makes me think that the world's just really misogynistic and
that too.
Sexist and that too. Awful. But,
and
okay.
And I think also having Troy through season two benefits that character because she has that extra year of...
You know what? You're absolutely right. Okay. Yeah. So then Troy at number 5, Crusher, we agree, number 6 then. Mm-hmm. That leaves Geordi at 7.
Yeah.
So we got the 8 and 9 spot. I would give it to Wesley Crusher at number 8 and then... Yar at number 9. Would you agree with those rankings there?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, Yar at 9 makes sense. Okay. I don't know. Where does Ensign Row? Is she at 10?
I would actually put Guinan above, say, honestly, probably Geordi.
Yeah.
Like, if we really got into it.
Yeah.
So then where would O'Brien go? Above Row?
Right to DS9.
Okay. So much to get into on that. But I like how we keep going back to like kind of our love for the characters here. But why don't we segue a little bit and talk about kind of the legacy of the aliens that we see on Star Trek The Next Generation. Why don't we just, you know, cut right to it. Let's talk about the development of the Borg here. We had an entire episode devoted to it called Evolution of the Borg Throughout Next Generation, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, all their appearances. What do you make of this Maurice Hurley creation, Cameron?
The Borg are really cool. You know, right from the get-go, it's like, look at the Klingons in the original series. Look how long it took them to figure out what a Klingon is, a Klingon means.
You know, I just watched Errand of Mercy.
Yeah.
I kind of think that they're very intriguing in that episode,
yes.
But they don't necessarily represent what they came to be by this time Next Generation
starts. It's a very, very good episode, very well written.
I loved it, yeah.
And Kor is a fantastic character, but he doesn't feel like, you know, the Klingons we know and love.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Borg are birthed onto the show, fully formed. And that is the most pure representation of the Borg we would see. And I would actually argue they get worse with time. Right from the get-go, they're so strong. They had them just nailed down, which is so rare. You know, you look at the Ferengi with their laser whips early on in The Last Outpost. Yeah. You know, we said the Klingons were iffy out of the gate. The Borg might be... I don't know. Are they the most well-formed sort of classic staple of Star Trek?
Alien? I would say out of the gate because what they represent right in Q-Who is so scary. You don't need to change it that much.
Yeah.
I think they probably reach their peak at I-Borg and then they start to slide down. We have episodes like Descent. It's still pretty scary to watch them in Emissary during the Battle of Worf 359, but from there... I think we discussed it. Voyager, they appeared in as primary antagonists in 22 episodes.
Yeah.
Versus, I think, 8 or 9 appearances on Next Gen.
Right.
So, but I love what they wore. In so many, like, great episodes, like Best of Both Worlds, I-Borg as well. There's a lot of great standout episodes featuring them on Voyager, like Scorpion, for example. But I think they were at their best when it was Next Gen.
You know, I mean,
what is it about them that people relate to or find so frightening, Cam?
I think it's the zombie aspect.
Just the zombie aspect.
Just the sense that you cannot stop them.
Yeah.
They will just keep going. They're completely unemotional. And it's just a horde.
And look,
that doesn't respond to reason or anything you can say.
Next Generation slowed them down, but they never defeated the Borg,
right.
Which was fascinating and makes them all that much scarier as well. Why don't we? Okay, you mentioned Ferengi.
You know, I think one of the real the themes of the aliens in TNG is that, you know, I'm a huge original series alien guy. Like, I love the aliens they created on that show. But if you watch that series, the aliens are a little more colorful. They're broader. They have a sort of a quirkier or idiosyncratic look to them or feel or just the way they're played. Whereas when you get to TNG, they become very grounded. Like, there's a sense that it's not the humans versus the very colorful, you know, outsider species. It's like a lot of the aliens on TNG feel like they could be the stars of their own show.
Like, they represent kind of different aspects of humanity as opposed to some just ridiculous sort of...
Like alien other character, you know, type character. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think the fact that they find that humanity... But I think that was also maybe something that didn't quite happen until season three when Michael Piller took over.
I mean, you could make arguments that, you know, while the Ferengi weren't nailed down at the gate, you know, they were a little wacky, but they were still had a central philosophy that they could explain with the Ferengi early on. They weren't written well. They weren't particularly entertaining to watch. But they nailed down who these characters were, like what this alien species like wanted, essentially. Like, what was their drive?
But I think with the Ferengi, there was enough there that they, like, despite the fact that they didn't become these frightening antagonists like I think they were intended to be, they were iconic enough, they were distinct enough that they kept using them. The Ferengi kept coming back and back and back. And I think there's a reason for that. And they worked to a degree. And the fact that they became so well developed on Deep Space Nine, I think you have to give you know, props to Next Generation for, even if The Last Outpost wasn't a great introduction, they saw something there and they went with it.
Yeah. And you would see, like, TNG would occasionally try for a TOS-type alien like the Antidians. You know, the giant fish chicken aliens?
Played by Mick Fleetwood?
Yeah. Is that the Outrageous Okona episode, I think?
I think it was.
I think it is.
Yeah.
But you could see how they tried that. And, you know, it just didn't feel like it belonged on TNG.
I know.
And I think there's a reason fans will make fun of them to this day. You know, in an episode that is otherwise completely forgettable.
Yeah. I just wish they brought back those cat's paw aliens instead on the little pipe cleaners.
Right, the little rod puppets.
Yeah. Cardassians, though, they were introduced in The Next Generation. And Deep Space Nine.
They're such a DS9 species, but yeah, no, I mean, it's true.
But the fact is that they were cool enough, they were layered enough. You get an episode like The Wounded that introduced them as such a distinct, kind of cool alien that DS9 obviously saw something there and took up the mantle and made a lot of sense, though. And I think their introduction in Next Generation is very important.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like, the Cardassians, you know, are just such astonishing creations. And also, actually, what, you know, TNG did to, like, evolve, like, the Romulans, for example.
Yes.
And just the Romulans became so much more interesting and layered. Like,
well, they weren't even supposed to appear on Next Generation. Like, Roddenberry was adamant about, like, reintroducing old TOS aliens. But we get the Romulans at the end of season two.
Yeah.
Cam, worth it?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
think about episodes like The Defector, you know, The Enemy. Yeah. We also have, what was the Great Troy episode in which she...
Oh, Face of the Enemy?
Face of the Enemy as well. Yeah, I guess they are the enemy. They like using that terminology.
I think of it like TOS made the aliens pop, but TNG made them live and breathe. And I think that's sort of the philosophy of that show's approach to aliens were, is that these are beings that deserve the respect that, you know, Picard does.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Riker or whoever. And so we never get the sense that they're played broad.
On that note, I'll make a bit of an argument. I don't know if it quite works more as a character than a species, but Q.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I think it's such an iconic sort of life form at this point, brought onto DS9 as well as Voyager. I think all of that credit has to go to John Delancey. If this was played by any other actor, I don't know if, you know, we would know the Q as we do today.
No, I agree. I mean, you could see William Campbell kind of touching on this type of character in the original series, in The Squire of Gothos.
Trilene.
Yeah, but this was very much, again, like, you know, Trelane's a fun character, whereas TNG's like, we're going to make a great character.
Like a scary kind of character,
but
though.
A character, you know, with interesting moral code, who has like complex relationships with some of the crew members.
Did we ever figure out why Q cared so much about humanity?
No.
Or do you think he's just bored?
Or do you think there is any way for us to understand why?
Maybe it's just beyond our comprehension.
Yeah.
But do you think Q genuinely cared about the crew?
The crew...
Is it more just
Picard? He did, yeah.
Okay. I think we've had this discussion on the podcast before. I originally said, nah, But you convinced me that he must. You know, why else is he doing all this sort of
stuff? Why isn't he hanging out with, you know, Jellicoe or Captain Stiles or whoever?
Yeah. There's a reason why he gave up on Sisko.
After one trip, yeah.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, I'm not really feeling it, Ben. Sorry.
And even Janeway, it felt like he was kind of just like, eh.
Yeah, well, little did he know that Janeway's crew was going to be able to enter the continuum and confiscate guns from the rest of the crew. And I don't know. That episode, the crew and the gray, made no sense to me at all.
He wasn't popping in to see Archer either.
No. All right. Well, Cam, why don't we jump over? Any other aliens that we are forgetting here? I do want to give a shout out to the fact that the Klingons were fleshed out very much on Next Generation. All the same reasons that you had given before.
Yeah, and we've made fun on the show about the bumpy-headed aliens. Like, TNG very often would have characters pop up who are just these kind of bumpy aliens. But, you know, I mean, maybe that's part of the grounded, style of Next Generation. And it's not necessarily flashy, but that was also never the point. We should mention, too, though, the creation of the Trill.
Yeah. The Bajorans.
Bajorans are so important. And, Ensign Ro.
But it's amazing how these are all kind of TNG creations that appear in a few episodes, which is pretty typical of the series. You introduce an alien. If they're cool enough, maybe they'll appear in two more episodes. Deep Space Nine, they see the potential and they just mine it and mine it, which I think is, it speaks to the legacy of Next Generation as well.
Well, it's like TNG built the world and then the other shows benefited from it and expanded on it.
Yeah.
So why don't we move into round three of our picks of the episodes that are quintessential TNG?
Yeah, Cam, let's go back to you. You give us your next pick here.
Okay, so this is another, maybe one that's not on the tip of everyone's tongue, and this is the episode First Contact.
Mm.
This is an episode I really love
lot. You're a big cheer fan.
That's exactly why I
chose
this one.
BB Newirth.
Yeah. No, the reason I chose this episode is because in the original series, obviously they never had the Prime Directive. They sort of loosely did, like we shouldn't interfere, but then they always interfered, Kirk would be like, I don't like your planet and I don't like the way it runs, so yeah, we're going to make some changes.
Screw you, Organians.
Yeah, exactly. Gamesters of Triskelion. But what I love about this episode is that this is an episode that is really laying out the fundamental philosophy of TNG and really the Berman era as to how the Starfleet approaches alien cultures. And it's Picard. I mean, there is a whole subplot, yes, with Riker in alien disguise having to seduce, B.B. Newirth. But this episode, to me, really is about Picard taking an alien species through the steps towards, learning what Starfleet is and kind of potentially becoming part of Starfleet or of the Federation one day, maybe.
And you can tell that the Federation has learned this over a long period of maybe screwing this up multiple times. And I like it when we get to watch the infallible Federation screw things up. And this is not a perfect first contact.
No.
Recall Riker was the one who got trapped in that riot and he winds up in a hospital.
Yeah.
We also have an administration there that's very reluctant to accept this idea of aliens as well. And they're like, well, even if we can acknowledge this, we don't want our citizens to know about this.
And just the scenes of Picard laying out the philosophies and fundamental ideas of the Federation to this alien race is, to me, this could be so boring. And it's riveting. I'm on the edge of my seat because Patrick Stewart is so incredible.
Yeah.
But also, there's so much just power in his presentation and how much we believe as the actor, the character believes in, what he's, espousing to this alien ambassador.
Well, this episode, I don't think it would have worked on TOS. Would it have worked on Voyager or DS9?
Sisko, I can't picture given. I feel like, Picard is so eloquent. There's just a level of showmanship to Patrick Stewart's performance. I don't think Sisko has it. I think Janeway is the only one who might have been able to pull this off.
But I don't think Voyager they would have cared so much.
Voyager would not have an episode this serious, I don't
know.
This sort of, because when you lay out the log line as to what this episode is about, I think it's too low wattage for what Voyager does.
And I think on Enterprise, Archer would be like, so look, there's these gazelles, right? And some gazelles, they don't run so fast immediately. So like, first contact, bro. Yeah, man.
Let's watch some water polo.
Yeah. Let's pound it out, man.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, my next pick here. I'm going for more of the kind of high concept stuff that just blew me away at the time. I think this is kind of the hard sci-fi stuff where it's about the crew figuring out a big problem and just blowing me away, cause and effect.
Right.
This is probably my favorite. I put a top five high concept episodes. Brendan Braga, I don't know, that man just has something in his brain that just works. And when it's firing on all cylinders, I'm like, bro, you got it.
Yeah,
like,
because he wrote Parallels too.
He also, Genesis, that's another right. fantastic high concept episode that yeah. Braga seems to just have this natural knack for that. I absolutely dig. But I love the fact that, yeah, they solve the problem on something that would usually make me roll my eyes on a TV series, because Data essentially through different time periods keeps getting the number three replayed, or he understands that the number three is being played throughout the ship. It's a signal being sent to him. And the very last minute, Data looks at Riker's pips and sees three pips.
Right.
And so he's just like, let's go with Riker's plan, whatever he's suggesting before this ship crashes into us.
Right.
I was just like, oh, okay. That would usually make me cringe, but I thought it was just brilliant on the part of the writers here for Cause and Effect.
Yeah, that is another like iconic standout episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I kind of went, as I said before, went back and forth between that and Parallels.
So, Cam, why don't we mosey on over? We've covered the characters. We've covered the cool aliens. Why don't we take a bit of a dive into the movie franchise for Star Trek The Next Generation?
Dive is right.
I have very mixed feelings on this.
Yeah, me too.
First contact for me, I can know intellectually that it is perhaps not the finest Star Trek film ever produced, mm-hmm. but it is my favorite.
Like, and it is in many ways become the fan favorite. You know, it's this or Wrath of Khan,
yeah.
but I've often seen it tip towards First Contact.
A lot of people make arguments for it, and it's very different from Next Generation, the series.
Yeah.
They cover action in a way where Picard's really the action hero that you don't ever really see on Next Generation.
Right.
I think that's a mandate from Stewart. But there's so much good going forward that even you would have to acknowledge here. Even though I realize to you, it's not as cinematic as you would hope to get from Star Trek, especially on the big screen.
Right.
But you've got introductions of characters like the Borg Queen, which I think is great.
Yeah, she is.
Picard's a big... tour de force performance in the observation lounge with Lily. That is so iconic.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just cool moments here and there with Picard and Worf almost at each other's throats over the destruction of the Enterprise E as well.
Right.
I think this movie introduces conflict amongst the characters in a way that we never really saw in the series. And I think that's kind of a, well, yeah. I don't think mainstream film audiences are necessarily going to go for this idealistic sort of world where nobody has conflict within, you know, the crew.
And there's some real heart to it with the Cochrane character and his journey at the end. So, yeah, I agree. But, you know, you mentioned the Borg Queen. Was the Borg Queen TNG's last great contribution to Star Trek?
So, like, the legacy of the series?
Yeah.
I think you could make an argument for that, because really what comes after that? You've got the Sona.
Yeah. The Briar Patch.
Yeah, yeah. you've got Shinzon.
Yeah.
You know, the Riemans. We get to see some Riemans in Enterprise.
The Riemans are okay.
Yeah.
I mean, and we, you know, see Riemans later on the road.
But they're no Borg Queen, are they?
No.
Yeah. I think that must be kind of the high point of the film franchise's legacy anyway.
You almost kind of wish that's where they'd wrapped it up, because it would be going out so strong. Now, it was never going to wrap up after two movies,
no.
especially when the reception to this one was so strong.
But that's just it. If it wrapped up after this, everybody would have been complaining, like, how come you wrapped up in such a great movie? There's so much more potential to do.
Yeah.
Look, we've gone in depth on all four of these movies, but Cam, what do you think was kind of, where did they lose their way as this film franchise continued for the Next Generation crew?
Well, to me, I think they kind of lost it right at the start. Now, look, First Contact, as you said, you know, is significantly better than the other three. But I think right from the get-go, you know, Generations is coming out. You know, they're going to seg from TNG the series into TNG at the, you know, on the big screen. So we get David Carson to direct it on the same sets from the series. And it just feels like there's a lack of ambition in that film series. Now, look, all the pieces fell into place for First Contact. You know, it created the iconic images people wanted. It gave them the action they wanted. But I would still say it is scaled lower than a lot of the movies of that era. It just manages to work on the level that fans want.
I would say mainstream audiences as well.
Yeah, for sure.
It was a very financially successful film.
It has enough of the crowd-pleasing sort of sensations to it that I think made it a winning experience.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, Voyage Home did for Pete, you know, the mainstream audiences who maybe weren't big Trek fans in like 1986. But, you know, then the next two again are kind of back to a little bit middling, and you know, Nemesis goes a little more cinematic. It doesn't feel like Paramount's like, this is an A picture.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that's the problem.
They never felt that way during the TOS era films, though. What worked?
I'd say the first two felt a little more A-list to me.
I would say the first.
Yeah.
I think, okay, you said maybe the problem started with the very beginning, and I think you view First Contact more as a fluke than anything else. Is that accurate?
Well,
you don't particularly care for the movie.
Yeah, I think it's all right. I think the issue for me is like, I look at the fact there's four of them. One of them came out, you know, at least reasonably well in my eyes. So it feels like a bit of a fluke because it's a lot of the same group overseeing all four.
Well,
Nemesis is a little different.
And I think that's what I'm getting at, is that the producer behind it, the one constant figure was Rick Berman.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if he was the guy to bring Star Trek The Next Generation onto the big screen. I think you need a J.J. Abrams type to do this. And I know a lot of people might deride my opinion, but I think J.J. Abrams is a very talented producer, director, writer as well. And I think, you know, that's why those movies have been, you know, fairly successful, beyond maybe not as much as the others. But when we think of...
You know, you think of like what Nicholas Meyer did with Wrath of Khan, where he had far less money to work with than the motion picture.
But he was the guy for the job.
And he knew how to deliver moments that, even though they were, you know, cheaper than maybe some of the other blockbusters of the era, have stuck with the same level of impact as other blockbusters.
Yeah.
You know, people who aren't Star Trek fans will talk about, you know, Ricardo Montalban's performance or the earworms or things like that.
Yeah. Do any mainstream audiences ever refer to, I don't know, Picard stuck in the rocks in Star Trek Generations?
I wish.
Like, what do you think is the most enduring legacy of Star Trek Generations in mainstream?
I think just having Kirk and Picard together.
Yeah. But what?
The context doesn't matter. Just the fact it was the two of them in one movie.
So cooking eggs?
Yeah, sure.
And chopping wood? Yeah. I don't know. I'll say this. I just to be positive for a bit, I do like that at least after the first 15 minutes and up until the, you know, let's say minute 15 through minute 75, it felt like I was watching a Next Gen episode on the big screen.
Right.
You know, beyond that, once you get into the Nexus stuff,
yeah,
then the movie loses me.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I kind of thought it was cool just to see like the crew, you know, in some redressed sets, in some different uniforms and comm badges. You do have that sequence in the Astrometric Slab that was kind of memorable. But beyond that, I don't know. It was a very flawed movie, and I don't think anybody involved in the production is going to really get behind it. I think Insurrection kind of gets a bad rap in that I think it's the closest thing that we have to a big episode of TNG.
Definitely.
It felt very much like a middling TNG episode.
Yeah.
But it felt, I think, like more like Star Trek The Next Generation than any of the other movies that we watched from this crew.
And I would argue, you know, it's a better big screen TNG episode than like the X-Files I Want to Believe movie is as a sort of mid-level, you know, X-Files movie.
Yeah.
Like I think Insurrection is like maybe a couple script passes away from being legitimately good.
I just don't know if they ever would have grabbed mainstream audiences to get them into kind of that next realm of box office success with a concept like Insurrection. I just don't know if it really would have connected.
It's just strange to me that, you know, I mean, I guess because the original series had so many years building up to its movies that it felt like maybe mainstream audiences were a little more on board those. The TNG ones were kind of... First Contact's the high, but then it's, you know, diminishing returns from there on. It never, despite the fact TNG was watched by a lot of people.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like those characters, once they hit movie screens, had the level of sort of staying power or also like as much of a draw for audiences.
Do you think Kirk, Spock, and crew were just more of an institution?
I think there's probably a combination of factors. I don't think it's any one thing. I think when you have like especially like Wrath of Khan and kind of the next couple, they're all kind of landing within sort of, you know, the Star Wars era. So people are, you know, really into Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and kind of into that space opera phase. And Star Trek's probably the next best thing. You had all these other movies like, you know, like Crawl and all that sort of stuff, or Gore landing, but none of them were very good.
Right.
Whereas like the Star Trek movies were good. So it was kind of like a decent alternate option to see.
I don't know if I would just pin all the success of the TOS movies on the fact that people wanted to see the next closest thing to Star Wars.
I don't think it's the one thing. That's the thing. I think that's maybe one of the things.
Okay.
You know, I think it was, yes, you know, Kirk and their iconics, probably more so Spock, I would imagine, for people. I just think
what about Chekhov? Was he drawing the crowds? One Walter Koenig?
I don't know. I think there's probably just a number.
I also just wonder if there's more fragmentation of audiences by the 90s. Yeah. Like, I think it's kind of tougher competition with, you see, you know, this is the era of like Roland Emmerich really coming into his own as kind of a box office sort of the guy who's kind of influencing like the way that we see blockbuster movies, you know, well, like the sci-fi side of things anyways. I'm thinking of movies like Independence Day or Stargate.
Sure, yeah.
You know.
And also just the fact, yeah, I mean, you know, in the
this does not feel like an Independence Day sci-fi adventure.
When the original Star Trek movies are hitting in the 80s, I'm excluding motion picture, but when they're hitting in the 80s, that's sort of the beginning of the blockbusters, you know, and so they kind of mix it up. Some of them look like really flashy, like a Top Gun or something like that. Others are a little lower budget, but they're still playing, you know, to summer audiences. Whereas by the time we get to the next gen movies, if you want to compete, you got to really bring it. Or else you look kind of like you're only half trying.
Yeah.
You know, like Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers comes out, you know, in 97 as like a November release. And it looks really, really impressive.
So, Cam, I don't know. Where would you have liked to have seen the next gen movies go? Are we just... Is it a fatal error that we never got to see a Q movie?
I think so. I think that would have been something that maybe would have given them a little more punch. I think what they need to do is, you know, Rick Berman, very successful TV producer.
Yeah.
You cannot take that away from whatever you think of him. He was very successful with his run on Star Trek. But he's not a movie producer. And I think he
just didn't have the vision, I think.
I think they needed to bring someone in to change the vision of TNG, because the original series movies are not like the original series.
No.
They needed, I think, someone to come in, and I think Stuart Baird tried that with Nemesis, but it was too little too late, and what he came up with was not particularly liked at all.
Well, what was the problem, Stuart Baird, or do you think it goes kind of back to the script process, the John Logan, Brent yeah. Spiner script?
I just think that whole project was just, I question how much like real effort was being put in at that point, too. You know,
well, I think you're right. They were trying to change things up, but then you end up with stuff like Picard in a dune buggy because Patrick Stewart wants to make him more of an action hero. And it's just like, it's stuff that's falling flat. And I think the lack of familiarity that Baird had did not help things, even though we are asking for Star Trek to think more cinematic. But it's just, I think it's a confluence of events that just did not bode well for that. And it's disappointing that we kind of left the crew. Like, that's the last we see of the crew altogether, right?
Yeah.
And it ends with Data jumping into a hole.
Right.
And Geordi staring blankly. You know, it's just kind of like, wow.
I think, too, you know, the original series was never graced with an ending until you get to the movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, Turnabout Intruder is the final episode, and it's not, it's just a standalone episode. Whereas, like, TNG, you know, All Good Things is such a great episode and finale, that it ends those characters in such a perfect way that it almost requires a little more of a justification for continuing them into the movies. And mm-hmm. I don't know that the movies ever earned that. You know, it never felt like they really, really paid off what they needed to justify it. And I think they could have. I think, you know, I don't know. I think nowadays, had a similar transition been made, it would have been taken very differently. Than in the 1990s.
Although I suspect, let's say Discovery becomes a cultural phenomenon.
Which it will.
And they're like, we need to bring this onto the big screen. We've got Alex Kurtzman. He's already executive producing this. Do you think Discovery, and again, we're days away from its premiere. We may be laughing at our own comments very soon. But do you think Discovery would have an easier time getting translated onto the big screen than what Next Gen had?
I think so.
I'm looking at it, already looks far more cinematic than Next Gen did.
Yeah.
You know, and this is based on like the clips that we've seen. You've got Kurtzman, who, whatever you say about his projects so far, he has a lot of experience doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, nowadays it would not be such a disappointing, you know, feat to get it from small screen to big screen.
No,
Star Trek, that is.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I think, you know, and I've talked about this in the past, where TNG's biggest problem towards the movies was, you know, like a lot of the characters got nothing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the original series, you had your three characters to focus mainly on, you know, Kirk, Spock, and Bones. With the TNG movies, it didn't have that sort of triangle.
No.
So it was like, okay, let's focus on Picard and Data.
We'll give Picard one story and we'll give Data another story.
Yeah.
And hope they can kind of, you know, like intersect, and which we saw in, you know, First Contact.
Sure.
But then...
But Picard and Data never have that type of relationship. So you don't have that level of connection between their two stories that I think is really important. It comes together best in First Contact, I think.
Not when Data's playing in Hay in Insurrection?
Good Lord. What were they thinking?
I don't know. So
he gets so much great stuff to do in First Contact with the Borg Queen, and then you cut to the next one, and he's like, in Hay? Oh, my God.
So, okay, you and I, we've kind of played around this with this idea, but who knows what's going to happen at this point with the TOS reboot film series.
Yeah. I don't think anyone knows at the
moment. but you have to believe maybe not, you know, in the next 3 years or 4 years, maybe 10 years from now, they will reboot Next Generation into a film franchise. What do you hope they accomplish, or what do you think would be the right path to take if this is what's going to happen?
I think what they have to do is look at the entirety of TNG and forget most of it. You know, keep the core, you know, who these characters are, what matters to them, what their world is, and re-envision it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's what J.J. Abrams did with the original, you know, his original series translations. And, you know, I know fans are, you know, have torn reactions to those based on the fact they are often more action-based. And I'm not saying I want TNG to be more action-based or anything like that, but I think if J.J. had carried over a little more of the philosophy, I don't know that people would argue at all.
Sure.
And I think with TNG, again, I don't know that you could make a translation of that and not keep the philosophy, because it's so ingrained in what TNG is.
Well, the problem is when they did bring that into Star Trek Into Darkness,
yeah,
it was all about 9/11 truthers.
So you're
like,
crazy.
What?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay, what about this? Do they keep around characters like Wesley and Yar, who weren't necessarily core to it? Do you this hypothetical reboot in the middle of what would have been, I don't know, the equivalent of season 5? Or are you showing a story about this crew coming together, and which would include characters like Yar, Wesley, and so on?
Yeah, well, it depends. Are they doing it in the alternate timeline? Because they don't have to include some of those characters.
Like the Kelvinverse?
Yeah, the Kelvinverse.
Well, I'm asking what you think they should do, though.
I think if when they're making this movie, they're making it for everyone. They're not just making it for the people doing the Star Trek podcast or listening to the Star Trek podcast or whatever. So I think what they have to do is refine it down to what they think is necessary for an audience. Like, look, I would love to see Yar play a major role.
What if they kill her off in that first movie, though? And that gives Worf something to conflict that he has to go through.
Yeah.
Maybe there's hints at some sort of prior relationship between Yar and Data, and that gives him something to deal with. I think there's a lot of potential for a next-gen reboot.
No, I think you could do something really cool with it.
Yeah. What about the look of it, though? I mean, you're not a fan of the cinematic look that we got from, say, Generations of the Enterprise.
But I don't mind the dark sort of Generations look. I know people really like to crap on it, but I don't know.
Myself included. Yeah. But what do you do? Do you do the equivalent of what J.J. Abrams did, where it looks absolutely nothing like the original series Bridge, for example? Or do you want to give certain homages, like obviously Worf's console that I think is very iconic.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I think you have to keep the sort of the overall sort of placement and of the characters within the bridge.
Right.
But you cannot replicate that 1987 bridge. You just can't.
With the wood panel, fake wood paneling?
The tan.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't. Like, I would love to see it, but it would look so goofy when this happens in, like, 2028 or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? You just... And I'm not saying do the J.J. Abrams kind of, you know, iStore or Apple Store sort of look. You just have to keep the core idea as to, you know, we've got the consoles up front, we got Worf at the back, or Tasha Yar, whoever it may be. And you just have to kind of capture the spirit of it.
I picture this kind of overarching, kind of similar color scheme as to what we're seeing in maybe Discovery right now, where it's kind of a lot of these deep blues and holographic screens, but it's kind of that updated, like, overall layout that we have on the bridge. As long as they have that cool pool table in main engineering, They can update the warp core all they want. Give Geordi his little office. I'm cool with that as well. I'm not going to be too beholden to what... Look, if you look at Next Gen nowadays, it very much looks like an 80s kind of set.
Right. No, right. I agree.
Cam, why don't we talk about some more episodes? What's another pick from your list here?
So my next episode, my number 4 pick for the essential TNG episode is The Inner Light. I mean, I talked about how Picard, I think, is the greatest character on that show, and this is his greatest episode. Can you imagine this episode with Kirk?
I feel as if it'd be an episode, what's the one where he becomes an indigenous person for...
Oh, the Paradise Syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. It could be something along those lines where you're just like, what am I watching?
That's actually not a bad comparison, really.
Yeah.
Is The Inner Light Picard's Paradise Syndrome?
That's what they're trying to recreate here.
It's not, you know, there's some similarities there.
But does Paradise Syndrome...
There are some real similarities. Holy smokes.
But does Paradise Syndrome work as well as The Inner Light?
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad you can be honest for once. Yeah.
No, but I mean, this episode is such an amazing character study. And, you know, the fact that this hour-long show traces an entire life and is so poignant is just... So few shows could have pulled that off. Star Trek or whatever. I don't care what show it is. You know, there's a level of high concept to it, but it is so rich and so layered and has so much emotion to it that it's a type of thing you would expect from, like, a great movie.
I'll just say the reason I left it off my list, though, is because...
You hate the flute.
Yes. I can never get the notes right when
You're more of a piccolo guy.
It's because this seems like such of an anomaly of an episode. This is not necessarily like a typical Next Gen episode. So if you... drop it on somebody's doorstep and they've never watched Next Gen ever, I don't know if this is the best representation of the Next Generation, even though I love this episode. It's one of my favorites. But
can you imagine any other Trek series making this episode?
Other
than the original series with Paradise Syndrome.
Yeah. Would this work? Well, we have to go with the captain characters.
Yeah.
Look, Sisko already has a family.
Yes.
You know, he has Cassidy, he has Jake. You know, I don't think it works. This story works for Sisko. Janeway, she was the den mother. She had her cubs. They were, you know, Tom and Harry and Seven.
Right.
And Chakotay. And the Doctor.
Right.
And Neelix.
Kes.
And Tuvok.
Yeah.
And V'Elanna. Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't think this really works as well as like somebody who's seeking out or who didn't even realize he craved the family that he gets here. Archer.
It's more like he's in a frat house.
Yeah.
Toga, toga.
Yeah, he's smashing guitars on people's heads. You know, I don't think Archer, I like Archer, like Scott Bakula. I don't think he's rich enough of a character. We do get great moments or episodes like Twilight, for example.
Yes.
But I just don't. I think Twilight might be his Paradise Syndrome.
Because he sparkled?
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's just the sense that, you know, this is such a deep...
It took me a minute. I get the joke now.
It's such a deep character study of Picard, you know? Like, and I don't think any other series was as fascinated with its captain as Next Generation is.
Right. Okay, my pick, though, I'm going with one that I don't think turns up on too many top 10 lists, but it's who watches The Watchers.
I knew you were going to.
You knew I was going to. You, because I've said it so many times on the podcast that I think this is really kind of the right personification of Next Generation, where essentially they F up a first contact with the species. And you see Picard, he has either a bad decision or, on the other hand, an even worse decision. So how does he handle this? Essentially, these proto-Vulcan sort of species, they think of Picard as kind of a god of some sorts, and he has to prove to them that he's not. And whatever he does, he just keeps screwing it up. And I just love this. And this is really where I think Piller starts to make his mark here. And this is very, I think this is like episode 3 or 4 of season 3 when Piller just jumped on. I think this is how you make a bang when it comes to you know, making your entrance known as the new showrunner here. I love this one so much. And to me, it just screams what this is what TNG does best, really.
It's interesting we both pick kind of similar episodes, you know, because you picked this one. I picked First Contact.
Yeah.
Very much about how to deal with the Prime Directive in a serious way. And what I like about Who Watches the Watchers is that it's very much like a procedural. It's like, how do we solve this problem? You've got to go down the checklist of what to do.
Yeah.
Try this. Nope, that didn't work. Let's try this. Okay, that didn't work. And I really like that approach that
it
has.
It's great. And it gets overlooked because it doesn't have like kind of that emotional gut-wrenching impact that an episode like The Inner Light would have, or even, say, Family or you know, Best of Both Worlds. But it to me, it's just like, yes, this is Star Trek.
Why do you think they didn't make action figures of Riker and Troi dressed as proto-Vulcans, but they did make a figure of Riker in the alien costume from First Contact?
I've never even thought about that, Cam.
You will now. It'll keep you up
at night. Yeah, no, I would have loved to have seen Troi and Riker with their awesome Vulcan haircuts there.
Yeah.
This is a proto-Vulcan species. Why do they still have kind of the bowl cuts? In like, they're living in the equivalent of like the year zero.
Are they using like stone bowls?
Yeah.
To cut their hair.
Anyway, Cam, why don't we kind of wrap this discussion up with maybe just an overall talk about our relationship to Next Generation, what we think the legacy represents to not just us fans, but maybe mainstream audiences there. But you came into Next Gen a little bit late in life.
Well, yes and no, because, you know, I started watching Next Generation when I was, you know, reasonably young. I was probably about 12, I guess. It was when it was in syndication in the afternoons. And so I saw Cause and Effect was the first episode I ever saw. And then, you know, that I watched that in actual prime time. And then I began to watch when it was doing like 4 o'clock reruns. On weekdays, and I, you know, saw Best of Both Worlds. I saw, you know, a lot of those kind of like seasons 3 and 4 in syndication. And, you know, I probably saw maybe 20 or 30 episodes. And I never really stuck with it, but in many ways, it was my first Star Trek. You know, while I had seen the original series films, I had never watched the original series, other than I'd seen the episode Arena when I was quite young, but it didn't, you know, I didn't watch any more of the original series. And so really TNG was my introduction to TV Star Trek.
Yeah.
And, you know, for whatever reason, I wound up moving on to other things. I don't know, Xena Warrior Princess or something, who can remember? But, you know,
you're like, forget Star Trek, give me some more of this Lex.
And, you know, I would have been curious in an alternate universe what would have happened, because I saw all the TNG movies, even though I was not watching the show, you know, further down the road. But I wonder what would have happened had those movies played like gangbusters to me, if I would have been sucked back to go and rewatch Next Generation.
But it did still take you a while to go back and watch all of
definitely.
TOS.
Yeah, because, well, you mean TNG?
Is it TOS? TOS, yeah. You had seen all those movies.
Yeah, it wasn't until, 2009 I went and watched TOS, then I did DS9, and then I went back and watched TNG.
Oh.
And just rediscovering TNG, it was interesting how close it was to my memories of it, in terms of sort of the more adult approach it had and the level of sophistication, but how also different it was in that, I don't know, when I was young, I picked up on the level of fun it was having kind of in the margins. You know, the stories tend to be quite serious on TNG, But, you know, you have your Riker moments. You have your little comedic bits with, you know, Picard being a little pompous or something, kind of operating in the margins. They aren't as, like, overt as TOS. But, you know, I've complained on this podcast about how a lot of the characters on TNG are a little too perfect for me, and I think that is why I tend to side a little more with TOS or DS9. But I do really appreciate how much TNG kind of gets that Star Trek hangout vibe and, you know, lets you feel like you know these characters on a more intimate level than you do, I think, with the Voyager, you know, Enterprise.
Yeah. Cast. Well, you know, you've just said it, TOS is your favorite series, DS9 is my favorite, but I will make this argument. I think Next Generation represents Trek at its peak.
Yeah.
You know, this is where both popularity-wise, as well as just showing you what Star Trek could do week after week after week and actually grip people in a way. And is there a show comparable to Star Trek The Next Generation, though? Like, what would you compare it to? Like, I don't think there's, when it was airing, there's really nothing like it. And the closest comparison you could draw is maybe the original series, but they were so distinct because the genius here is that Next Generation wasn't trying to be the original series.
No, and I was actually, I did a bit of research just on science fiction television of the era. And you could just tell that it was kind of in not a great place. You know, in the 70s, you had some serious shows like Space 1999, or there was the attempt at the Planet of the Apes TV series, which was, you know, only made it one season. And then it kind of, you know, Star Wars comes out, and a lot of the shows get a little more popular. Like the original Battlestar Galactica you have in the late 70s and early 80s. Again, much more like a Star Wars riff. It wouldn't be till the, you know, the revamped Battlestar Galactica that where they took it more seriously. Mm-hmm. You had Buck Rogers. And then, you know, you have V in 1984, which was a little more serious. But other than that, it was like anthology shows, like Amazing Stories or Twilight Zone. TNG comes out in 87. And, you know, regardless of how you feel about those two seasons, the first two seasons, people were watching it. And shortly thereafter, you begin to see, you know, series like War of the Worlds, Alien Nation, Quantum Leap, leading right into Babylon 5, X-Files. Like, you'd see how TNG got the ball rolling again for, like, serious sci-fi on TV.
I think the moment that I realized that Next Gen was having an impact on more than just me, though, like, I mean, we talk about it at the playground, but I remember watching Wayne's World, and they were having that debate about champagne versus sparkling wine, and Wayne brought it all into kind of a debate over the original series versus the Next Generation. And I was just like, wow, other people think about it in these terms. It's not just like me, this kid, you know. I thought that was fascinating. It had a huge impact on pop culture. I think you're going to find so many people. It's amazing to just encounter people on the streets that's, I don't know, they're like, oh, you do a Star Trek podcast? I like the Next Generation. Like, I find so many more mainstream Next Gen fans than anything else.
Definitely.
You know, and I just think that there's just something unique about that time period in which I'm watching these reruns, and I think they hold up and endure quite well in a way that surprises me 30 years later. And I think that's a reason why its legacy has endured so well.
Yeah, I mean, just rewatching episodes for this podcast, you know, like we did the episode The Outcast, we talked about that, too, you know, not too long ago. And just going back and just watching kind of these cherry-picked episodes for the podcast, I'm just like, wow, this is such great writing and with a level of sophistication that you don't see many shows doing that. And I just wonder how much of that is the fact it was such a closed group making it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't on, you know, it was a syndicated show. So it was kind of, you know, Roddenberry and then, you know, Pillar and all that kind of putting out this show and selling it to the various groups. Whereas, like, if it's a network show, you got every voice coming into this thing. And I just think it's really powerful how undiluted this show is. It's very, like, the pure essence of TNG. It never feels like sacrificed. You may not like episodes. You know, there's lots of episodes we don't like that we love to call out on the podcast, but they are TNG episodes. They never feel like they were compromised and here's, you know, a wacky sitcom character that came wandering in or something like that.
Cam, are you hopeful for TNG getting kind of the same legacy that TOS had after 50 years? We just had the 50-year anniversary of TOS last year.
Yeah.
And people are still remembering that show. I think Paramount/CBS kind of dropped the ball on really putting forward a lot of recognition for the series. But among fans, and a lot of bloggers and just like mainstream people, they're like, wow, like 50 years. And I think that legacy has held up over 50 years. Do you think Star Trek Next Generation 20 years from now, it's going to get a similar response?
I think so. Yeah. And it's, you know, one, because it's a great show. But second of all, you know, you look at the Berman era of Star Trek for, you know, multiple, at least a couple generations, that is their Star Trek.
Yeah.
And you can argue whether you like Voyager more, whether you like Deep Space Nine more, Enterprise, whatever. They are all existing in the shadow of what TNG created. They may have, you know, evolved into different paths, but they're all living within its universe. And so, you know, that really does define a massive, a huge chunk of Star Trek. More, I mean, there will never probably be a creative run on Star Trek like the Berman era.
No, the fact of the matter is just viewing habits are way too fragmented nowadays.
Yeah.
There's just no way it can be done.
You know, you look, J.J. Abrams reinvents it for, you know, the 21st century. He's on it for two movies.
Yeah.
You know, and then Justin Lin takes over. Like, already that vision's been kind of,
yeah,
you know, changed when Justin Lin comes on board. So it's like, the gatekeepers of Star Trek are going to have far shorter lifespans than what Michael or that Rick Berman had. I was going to say Michael Burnham.
Yeah, your mind's already on Discovery.
Yeah. But yeah, and you know, just that era is so, it's such an anomaly within the history of television, really.
Okay.
And that so much good came out of it. It never really, I know people, you know, have their issues with Enterprise or Voyager, but those shows are so pure to what they are in a way,
yeah,
that it's kind of admirable whether you like them or not.
Well, Cam, why don't we wrap up this discussion with our final episodes that we think kind of exemplifies what Star Trek The Next Generation is all about. I'll start with this. I would be remiss if I did not include a Q episode, and if I did not talk about mortality if we're having a Star Trek discussion.
Yeah.
So I went with Tapestry.
Okay.
Because I think this is an episode where it's, of course, Picard dealing with his own existential crisis in a moment where he's essentially having that near-death experience, and he relives his life as an old man, but making decisions on behalf of his younger self. I think we've all had that kind of fantasy of like, oh, if only I can go back and tell myself, you know, like 10, 15 years ago, do this or don't do that. Then you realize you learn a lot from that. I love how Star Trek articulated that kind of journey, that experience. And there's nothing better than watching Loser Picard in his blue science uniform in this new alternate reality. This is such a fun episode, but it's actually an episode with a lot of layers, a lot of meaning. It's a serious episode, too.
Another great character study of Picard.
Yeah.
You know, the Picard definitely got the most character studies of any captain.
Yeah. I would say, if you look at DS9, though, it's such a ensemble series,
yes,
more so. I mentioned before, I just don't know if Braga was the guy to give a captain so many deep layers. I think he was more successful on Voyager than he was on, say, Enterprise.
Right.
You know, maybe he started going there, season 3 of Enterprise. But, yeah, you know, but you're right. I think Picard's just, he lends himself to so many great character studies. I think a lot of it has to do with, you've got a powerhouse like Patrick Stewart playing this dude.
Is he the deepest character in Star Trek?
The deepest character. I would say Sisko's the most complex.
Yeah.
You know, is he the deepest? I say you make a very, very good argument for Picard being the deepest character.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Most layered. You know. Okay.
Actually, I picked also a Q episode, though. I picked All Good Things.
Okay.
Because to me, like, All Good Things, you know, you look at the ambition, the level of writing, the scope, and what this, you know, episode says about the philosophy, about the entirety of TNG, you know, the Picard is defender of humanity. We get to see Q in one of his most iconic forms in this episode. We get to see a great...
Just as Beethoven?
We get a great high concept, episode where we're bouncing around in time. It's a little Slaughterhouse 5, actually. Again, we get to see the beginning of humanity right to the end. So this, two-parter, it isn't your average episode of TNG.
Sure.
But it's such a perfect encapsulation as to what TNG was all about all along.
It's hard not to love this episode.
Yeah.
I really want to find the fan that was disappointed with this as a series finale, as a way to wrap up the show.
No one was, right?
I can't. Who is that jerk who's who must just be like a big poopy pants?
There might have been someone at the time who had in their, you know, their own mental vision, sure, of what the finale would be. You know, what the crew was, what was going to happen. Like, lots of people, when you come to a hugely awaited finale, whether it's like a Seinfeld finale or X-Files finale or whatever, like, all the fans have their own version of what this ending is. Maybe not so much with like a Home Improvement ending, but you know, when it comes to TNG, I'm sure.
Wait, what was the ending of Home Improvement?
I don't know.
Oh, okay,
I think they moved. Maybe, I don't know.
Oh yeah, you're right. I remember there's that scene where they literally put the house on like a tractor trailer.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah.
Wow, we should start a Home Improvement podcast, Cam.
But you know, everyone I'm sure had their, you know, their own TNG finale in mind, and maybe there was like that person that was like, that is not what I wanted to see out of the finale. Yeah. But I have a hard time imagining that that same person coming back to that finale didn't change their mind.
Okay, Cam,
so that kind of wraps up our TNG discussion, but we're gonna go to a segment that I think we're gonna do for the next little while, and that's, we're gonna take a trip on the good ship Ortonville.
The Ortonville, you say?
The Ortonville.
What is this in reference to, Cameron?
So Tyler, we talked last week about the Orville. We talked about the pilot episode of Seth MacFarlane's new show,
old wounds.
Yeah. It opens up some new wounds for one of us. But, you know, it was kind of decided at the end of that episode, I wasn't going to watch the Orville.
You're not sticking
anymore
around.
I was tapping out. But you are going to continue.
It just, to me, it comes down to curiosity factor.
Sure.
This is trying to be Next Generation. Like, no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So I'm just intrigued by what, like, a Next Gen homage would look like. I thought it was pretty rough last week. I saw a lot of fan response saying that episode 2, I'm blanking on the name of the episode, was much stronger.
Can you give us a bit of a log line? Like, you know, in a sentence or two, what is this episode about?
The captain and the first officer, they're kidnapped and placed in an alien zoo.
Oh, there's a TOS animated episode.
Well,
like that.
Even kind of like the cage or menagerie as well.
That too, yeah.
So, which we've kind of seen this before, and really, the episode kind of centered more on the security officer who's 23 years old and she's put in charge of the ship, and her trying to figure out how to be a commander, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I think those scenes worked a little bit better. You know, the comedy stuff still isn't really working for me.
Right.
I actually found this one a little harder to endure than the than the first one.
Okay.
I thought the first episode was fine.
Yeah.
I think this is fine. I find the series perfectly watchable.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a fantastic series, but I think it's fine. And nothing so far has led me to believe that I'm going to rescind my promise to continue on with it. But I don't know. I just wish that they would. Okay. Here's the thing: is they're trying to take a lighthearted look at Star Trek.
What do you make of the fact that, like, apparently Seth MacFarlane said he wanted to have its own mythology and not to be compared with Star Trek?
I don't think that's actually what he said.
Yeah, though. I don't think so either.
I think people are misinterpreting quotes. But so what they're trying to do is have like a lighthearted take on Star Trek.
Right.
And I think what's way more, for comedy purposes, what's way more punk rock is for you to take the series that you love and re-envision it and subvert expectations. And I think they're not quite subverting expectations in, oh, this is how you resolve it. You can kind of see the resolution coming from a mile away to a certain degree. I think the show would benefit on the comedy side of things and from the storytelling side of things if they would try to work within the parameters of Star Trek that they love so much and then just totally flip it on its back in a way that's still honors the legacy of Star Trek, but it's still its own thing. And
right.
I think I have hope that they start to figure that out. The first two episodes, both penned by Seth MacFarlane. We're going to have a Brandon Braga penned episode coming up eventually, I have to assume. Jonathan Frakes is directing. You know, there's some big Star Trek names attached to this. Another reason why I'm just curious about like what all these Star Trek names are going to do.
Who directed this one?
I am blanking.
You're not sure? Cause is it Robert Duncan McNeil's doing next week's, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't believe this was a Star Trek. Okay. There was Ron Canada. He was in this one.
Okay.
So he played a Klingon on Deep Space Nine.
Right.
I don't know. I promise all other trips of the Ortonville won't be this meandering. I'll cut to the chase a lot sooner. Right. I'm not throwing in the towel just yet. I actually think this is a weaker episode than the pilots. I hear that episode 3 is a total train wreck.
Right.
So I'm curious just how much of a train wreck it'll be, but a train wreck I'm intrigued by. I'm not going to throw in the towel after a train wreck. If episode 4 is a total bore, then I'm going to have to reevaluate things. But I just want Seth MacFarlane be more punk rock. You know, you can still love this franchise that is Star Trek, but honor it in a way that is unique, as opposed to kind of a retread on something that we've seen before with some kind of lame jokes, I guess.
Right.
So.
Okay, well, speaking of the Orville, we had a voicemail come in from our foreign correspondent, Scott. Why don't we just play that for you? It was in regards to the pilot episode of the Orville. Scott sat down to watch it with his family, and let's hear his take.
Hey, guys. Scott Hardy beaming in from sunny old London, England. Just wanted to give my thoughts on the Orville by Seth MacFarlane, episode 1. I watched it just yesterday, and I took away two things. Firstly, it really does try to be both morality, play, and also a comedy at the same time. And unfortunately, when you do two things half-assed, you never really have a good product in the end, which I think really hurts the show. And secondly, it's a really loving homage to Star Trek, but at the same time, it just feels like Star Trek. And if I want to watch Star Trek, I'll watch Star Trek. That's where I sit on it. I also had the honor of watching it with my entire family of about 20 people. So their take was a bit different. We had fans of Seth MacFarlane's work and haters of Seth MacFarlane's work, as well as fans of Star Trek and haters of Star Trek in that group. So I thought it was a really good sort of testing platform to see how the show lands. Unfortunately, about one person out of the entire group loved it, and that was my nan, who's in her 70s. So I don't think it really landed that well, apart from the odd laugh, the odd toilet joke. Just wasn't really for anyone in the crowd, and it isn't really for me, unfortunately. So I'm officially off of the Orville hype train, and I'm directly boarding the Discovery hype train. Thanks, guys. This is Scott Hardy, signing off.
Yeah, I'm surprised that no one except for his nan liked it. I guess I'm the equivalent of Scott Hardy's nan.
Yeah, that's a...
Well, although I wasn't like... Cam, you and I watched the pilot together. Did you hear me laughing, though? Like, the way that his nan...
Out loud at all? No.
I think I smiled a couple times.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the same reaction as Dan. Is Scott trying to insult me here by saying that I have the same comedic sensibilities as his deteriorating grandmother?
Deteriorating?
Yes. We're all deteriorating, Cam.
That's quite true. That's very... talking about mortality on TNG. Yeah, no kidding. I just think it's interesting and a little damning that Seth MacFarlane's humor that he's putting into this show is only appealing to like the 70-year-old in the room.
Maybe the one who's into more of the broad comedy.
Well, you know, just comedy changes pace over time, right?
Yeah.
You know, comedy is a lot of it now is too fast paced for like older viewers. Like my parents can't watch, say, like Arrested Development. They just don't like it. It's too quick and too, you know, you got to stay on the ball constantly. Whereas, you know, you watch older comedies, they're a little slower paced, or the jokes are maybe a little more obvious. And I just think it's interesting that it's the older viewer who's kind of finding the Orville really funny.
I don't know, and maybe those Brits, they just have a more sophisticated sense of humor. That's why she's the only one that thought the jokes were funny, and the rest of the room thought it was just really bad.
But yeah,
I'm surprised the entire room, like everybody's just like, eh. So
yeah, no, I mean, I was honestly very impressed that Scott managed to assemble 20 people to watch this.
Yeah, how did he convince? Hey guys, so there's this really bad TV show that's not getting good reviews or anything like that, but it has to do with my favorite franchise. To a certain degree, you guys all want to watch it together?
This is a family night.
Yeah,
we could
take an hour to do this.
We couldn't even get Fallen Co-host Ben Young to show up.
No. Well, I have noticed that fan reaction online is
fairly positive.
Pretty positive.
Yeah.
You know, and I was kind of waiting for a lot of people to say, oh, this is stupid. A lot of people are. But I actually see that the reaction's far more positive than I was anticipating it was.
Well, Well, we live in a Star Trek vacuum, you know, on TV up until this week, basically coming up. And so, you know, the Orville does fill that void.
Yeah.
We'll see, you know, if Discovery comes out and is just like phenomenal, maybe people are going to care a little less about the Orville.
What
I don't
if
know.
Discovery is just absolutely laugh out loud hilarious on purpose, like it's just like firing on all cylinders, just hilarious joke after joke after joke,
like every episode is like Trials and Tribulations
pretty much. Yeah,
that would be definitely unexpected given the trailers.
Unexpected, like that really not funny episode of Enterprise.
exactly
just like Bortos giving birth to an egg in the latest episode of the Orville, which you did not watch, Cam.
Yeah,
anyways,
joke over my head.
I know. So Cam, we've got a little bit of housekeeping to do.
Yeah.
For our loyal listeners, we are going to be changing up the format of the podcast, I guess, for the next 7 weeks while Discovery's on the air. I think this is a good chance for us to...
Why, Tyler, are you saying it's be canceled after 7 episodes?
Well, of course, they're going to do half the season in the fall, the other half in the new year.
Right.
So we're going to be doing like kind of episode... I don't want to call them recaps or reviews. You and I, we have actually an idea in mind that's going to be a very different take on, I think, how podcasting is going to go for Star Trek Discovery. Because I realize, like, there's just everybody's going to be doing kind of the same old stuff, like, hey, didn't you like that moment or that moment? Like, you and I, we have an idea that's going to be completely different, but I think it's going to be very fun. And people who have enjoyed Subspace Transmission so far, I think you'll get kind of extra appreciation for what we're doing here.
Right.
So we'll keep it a secret for now, but we are changing the format up just a little bit in order for us to have a good excuse to have, like, fun, in-depth, critical conversations about the first time Star Trek's been on TV in 12 years. This is just so weird to think, but Cam...
And this is only the second time in this podcast's history we've been able to talk about new Star Trek as it came out. Beyond was the only other time.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, unless you count Star Trek Renegades.
I try not to.
Yeah.
Honestly, what did you like more, the Orville or Star Trek Renegades?
Oh, the Orville.
Yeah.
That's not even a question.
Okay, I'm just double checking because...
I'm looking at the wall behind your head right now. It's better than Renegades. Okay. Not quite as funny, though.
No, that's true. unintentional humor.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, can we make fun of Renegades for just a few more seconds? I just can't get over that roommate that just kept appearing in Renegades.
With a character always saying, this is so-and-so's roommate.
This is my roommate. This is my roommate. Like, okay. And then she randomly lost her arm. It got chopped off.
It was like a scene from Hot Shots.
Yeah, I was like, what am I watching? Like, I don't know. It was... I commend any fan that puts so much passion into a fan film, but Renegades was, like, it was offensive. Like to women... And to just people.
Entertainment.
Yes. It is not good.
It all starts at the script, people.
Yeah. So Discovery. But Cam, let me just take your temperature here. Like, what do you hope from Discovery? What are you feeling right now? What's your overall sense of anticipation with regards to the upcoming premiere in just a few days?
My sense right now is just, it's weird. We've seen very little from this show. But what we have seen has been remarkably consistent, almost too consistent, where it looks like it all could just be one episode.
Sure.
And so I'm worried that what I'm expecting is exactly what I'm seeing. Like, I hope that this show is going to surprise me. There's nothing I want less is the next week's episode for me to being like, yeah, there was that part from the trailer. There was that part from the trailer. Where it was really a lot what I expected.
You've kind of pieced it all together in your mind before.
Yeah, like, because, you know, do you remember Star Trek Beyond? We talked before that movie came out a lot about what is this movie really about? Because this marketing seems very vague. You know, we know little bits. And then we saw the movie and it was really all there was what the trailer, you know, you had the little twist with Crawl at the end. But for the most part, it was exactly what they'd marketed.
Yeah.
It was very simplistic.
Yeah,
I'm really hopeful, and I don't think this will be the case, but I'm, you know, that, you know, Discovery delivers more than that. I think it will.
I think it will. I'm genuinely excited, though. Like, if you took my temperature a couple weeks ago, I would have been like, I don't know, I don't really understand what Discovery is about. I thought it's cool every time we got some new information, but now it's just dawning on me. It's going to be Star Trek week to week for the foreseeable future. Unless CBS All Access is a complete unmitigated disaster, but you already have you know, the Netflix licensing fees that's paying for this. I think we've got at least a couple seasons of Discovery ahead of us.
Yeah.
I'm genuinely excited. Even if the show turns out to be a disaster, you and I are going to have a fun time talking about this disaster. But I don't get the sense that it is going to be a disaster. I think the worst it could be is safe.
Right.
Do you get the sense this show is going to be safe?
Well, it depends in what way you're saying safe. It's already, from what I've seen, it's not playing it Star Trek safe.
No.
Because if it was playing it Star Trek safe, it would be like a Voyager where it's, you know, like TNG light.
Right.
So it's not doing that. My only question, I guess, then is it playing it safe for what a general audience would expect from a space action show?
I think it might be.
That, yeah, that's the question mark.
That's my concern. My other concern, we've addressed this before, but my fear is that this might be far more beholden to the story as opposed to the characters.
Yeah, and that's also a worry of mine because, you know, just this episode, we've each, you know, mentioned these TNG episodes that mean a lot to us and how these episodes are really different from one another.
Yes.
And I'm worried we're going to be robbed of that with Discovery.
Well, because with serialized storytelling, you need to have consistent tone episode to episode.
Yeah.
You know, you can do bottle episodes. You know, we saw that in The Fly on Breaking Bad.
A very polarizing episode.
You know, but overall, Breaking Bad had a very consistent tone, as did Mad Men. They were able to do kind of like fun caper episodes or kind of existential crises episodes, but overall it didn't seem as if you're watching like in completely different series week to week, whereas with Next Gen sometimes it did like you're like this is a Sherlock Holmes episode,
right?
This is the episode where, you know, Riker's dealing with his own existential crisis over his career and what to do with the Borg at the same time, you know. I don't know if we're going to get that. I think the people behind it care deeply about the franchise, but I just wonder if they're going to be too beholden to this legacy of the franchise. You know, just too afraid to make the real, real scary decisions that I think we need with Star Trek. Star Trek needs to go forward. You know, we can't be looking too far back.
My worry, too, is that this show is going to be like the Marvel Netflix shows, where the craftsmanship is impeccable. You know, you look at like the, you know, some of the fight scenes in Daredevil, they're incredible, just incredible stuff, especially in season two. But the storytelling is very, like, even when it's good, you know, but it can be a little stretched out over its episodes. It just doesn't have the momentum. Like, you know, a show like Breaking Bad, or say, like, you know, you're a Game of Thrones fan, but, like, those types of shows are diamonds, you know, in the rough. You know, they don't happen every time a new, you know, major show comes around. And, you know, my worry with Discovery is that we're going to be watching good TV. That, you know, because of the fact serialization is, that's the fad right now. You know, that's the big trend. And that it's going to be feel beholden to the fact it has to be serialized, even at the expense of what could otherwise be maybe a strong 6-episode arc and then some standalones.
You also mentioned earlier the hangout factor that TNG got so well.
Yeah.
My other concern is that we're not going to get moments to breathe with the characters.
They're like, definitely not marketing the characters for this show.
I know. It's like, I want extended moments in the galley or whatever where they're just talking about
briefings with Neelix.
Well, that was my favorite spin-off potential there. But where they're just figuring out what it means to be human to a certain degree.
Or even just like talking about chocolate sundaes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to get chocolate sundae talk from Captain Georgiou? I don't think so. You know,
I want it from Captain Lorca.
Yeah, that's some whiskey sour talk that you're gonna get from him. Yeah. So I'm worried about Discovery, but
we started this little segment. We started like, I'm really excited. My temperature's high.
No, I'm very excited, but I am worried that they could just kind of miss the mark because they're too beholden to the legacy of Star Trek, where they just need to just go for it. Be its own thing.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the fans so much because there's never going to be a consensus among the fans. As long as you're not like trying to actively disgrace the memory of Star Trek, don't be too worried about what's come before. Because you know what? If I hate this show, not a big deal. I've got 700 hours of other Star Trek episodes to watch.
And I'll say, you know, right up front, like, I'm not worried about it feeling different because, you know, the Berman era TNG feels different than TOS.
Yeah.
I love TOS. I love much of the Berman era, whether it's DS9 or TNG, and then on to Enterprise. And so I'm ready for a change. I want this. I know people are very concerned about the continuity. I myself have griped about the Klingon look. Oh, but I'm willing to take the trip because I think Star Trek needs, you know, what is 21st century Star Trek?
Yeah.
You know, because like, look, I'd made the argument in the past, you know, the J.J. Abrams look was our modern era's approach to Star Trek, but it only lasted two movies, you know, like Justin Lin kind of dropped most of it. And so, like, I want to see what is Star Trek for the 21st century, and hopefully Discovery, you know, gives us something cool.
So far, they're saying the right things.
Yeah.
Let's just hope that they show us the right things in a few days, Cam.
Yeah, hopefully it's not all talk.
Okay, so we'll be back with the Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars in just a couple days, right?
So exciting. Can you believe it's a week away?
No.
I know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. What are some of your memories of Next Generation? What does it mean to you to look back on 30 years of Next Generation? What are some episodes you think we left out that are quintessential TNG episodes?
There are people yelling at their iPhones right now as they're listening to this podcast.
There is one episode in particular that they are raging that we did not
mention. I know. I'm glad that you did not include it, and I did not include it either. We're seeing eye to eye on that one. Okay.
Okay, let us know. Tyler, I mean, what are we doing next week? We're doing the Vulcan Hello and Battle of the Binary Stars.
Battle at the Binary Stars.
There you go, from Star Trek Discovery. And we'll also, oh no, I guess that one, that'll just be the full episode. We'll be talking about those two.
Yeah, those two. It'll be fun. And like I said, we are doing a different kind of review, recap, whatever you want to call it. It's not going to be anything that you've heard before. So keep tuning in, even if you don't have CBS All Access. We'll spoil everything for you.
Right. Now, we are also on the Facebook.
Yeah. Go to facebook.com/subspacepod or just search for Subspace Transmissions in your search bar on Facebook. We're going to be posting so much more content now that Discovery is going to be on the air. Cam, why don't we just let people know there's going to be blog posts essentially kind of giving people more insights into it as well. And we're going to keep posting exclusive videos, exclusive podcasts that you can't get on the feed. So don't miss out. Like us, follow us on Facebook.
Great. Okay. You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vengeance Factor, the other quintessential TNG episode, Smith.
No. you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Next Generation.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.